I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and there's been a flurry of political activity here in Massachusetts, where we are, that's reverberating across the country and to Washington. Republican Senator-elect Scott Brown, who'd previously said he was fine with being sworn in on February 11th, changed his mind late yesterday and asked to be sworn in today. So this morning, the Democratic governor and state officials certified the results of the January 19th special election, something they say they'd plan to do anyway. But now, in a rush of activity, Vice President Joe Biden will formally swear Brown in later today at 5 p.m. So what happened? And what impact will this have on upcoming votes, given that Democrats had already agreed to hold off on health care reform until Brown arrived in Washington? Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News, and he writes their blog, The Note. And Rick, you write today, Scott Brown can't wait to get to Washington. Now, we know his lawyer wrote a letter to the governor here yesterday. What did it say?
It said that he was made aware that there were a couple of important votes coming up, and therefore they wanted to have this election certified immediately instead of waiting another week so he could hire his staff and get ready. So he wanted the whole timeline moved up by a week.
Well, Brown's aides aren't specifically mentioning which votes, but we know there's a highly partisan close vote next week on the nomination of prominent union lawyer Craig Becker for a seat on the National Labor Relations Board. He's, of course, the Obama White House pick. It didn't seem to be on Scott Brown's radar before yesterday afternoon. You know, as he says in the letter, he'd been advised there were several votes. Do we know who advised him?
Well, Republican leaders were getting a lot of pressure from the grassroots in their party, people that were paying attention to this. And this particular person that you mentioned is a labor leader, and it's going to be a closely divided vote. So that was one issue. The other thing that's changed is that Senator Reid, the majority leader, has indicated that there'll be a vote early next week on a jobs bill. We haven't seen that bill yet, so we don't know what's really in it, but it is something that Republicans, at least some Republicans, will presumably oppose. So it's partly the schedule change. It's also partly that a lot of grassroots conservatives who were anxious to see Scott Brown seated immediately, didn't want to see any chicanery pulled around here, started to get nervous about this, and therefore they put some pressure on Senate leadership, who let Scott Brown know that they wouldn't mind his services a little bit earlier than expected.
Well, the Associated Press says that radio hosts and newspaper columnists were chiding Brown for taking a three-week victory lap since the special election. So, as you said, there was pressure coming up from below to Republican leaders. The conservative Drudge Report linked to the letter from the lawyer. It was so popular that it crashed yesterday. And it was presented as his demanding his seat. But as we said, Democrats say they were just following his initial request, getting ready for the 11th of February, and they've been accommodating him. But talk shows here have been sounding as if Brown wasn't being listened to by the Democrats. So a couple questions. How is this going to be presented, as the Democrats were foot-dragging and the Republicans have a victory, or as Brown didn't seem to know what was going on in Washington and that he was wanted there?
Yeah, I think this isn't his political scandal, but I think people were itching for a fight. Do you remember on election night, the chants that started, seat him now, just because there were suggestions that maybe health care could get done in the interim before he was seated? No Democrat has seriously suggested that his seating should be delayed. They worked out the schedule. Scott Brown was happy with the schedule before. I just don't think this is the scandal that some people thought. People were itching for a fight. It's almost like some of the Brown folks and a lot of conservatives were disappointed that that Harry Reid wasn't going to try any funny business. They would have loved the image of Democrats ramming through a health care bill or trying to get things done while they still had 60 votes when the people of Massachusetts had spoken.
Well, and what message is being sent to Brown in that he's, you know, being summoned to Washington? He campaigned as an independent, although he is a Republican. Do we know how he's going to vote on the Becker nomination?
I don't know how he's going to vote. I don't know that he's studied it yet. He's going to be under pressure, though, to be number 41 many, many times. And it's going to be an interesting tension to watch. Republicans that I've talked to, they know that he represents Massachusetts. They know that this is among the most liberal states in the country and that you don't get reelected from a state like Massachusetts by voting down the line with Republicans. But there will be times where they count on him, where they need him to do it. Well, they'll need all 41 Republicans to stand together. There'll be that expectation. And as we know, he is not quite as conservative as the party platform say, or is the majority of the members of his caucus.
Well, that brings us to one last quick question, and it involves the conflicts going into this weekend's Tea Party convention, the group's first. And the Tea Party movement, which includes organizations like the Tea Party Express bus tour, is claiming Brown's victory as theirs. But the Tea Party Express was created and is run by two GOP consultants who said today on CNN they feel the Tea Party movement belongs to Republicans. As you know, This is angering other Tea Party activists who feel the movement is being hijacked by the GOP. And then there are Tea Partiers who've been lobbying for a purity test for Republicans to make sure they're conservative enough. So, again, Brown says he's independent. How's he going to thread this needle?
It's going to be tough, and he's going to have to manage this movement. As he said to Barbara Walters over the weekend on This Week, he said no one has ever come up to him and represented themselves as part of the Tea Party movement. I find that hard to believe, and I think if they haven't done it yet, they're going to do it in the future. The Tea Party convention, Sarah Palin, all the energy that's going on out there, there's a lot of hope invested in Scott Brown as he takes office, and I think he's going to have to balance the very real demands and the sense of ownership that the Tea Party folks have with his own self-stated independence and his own desire to represent Massachusetts.
Well, and he's going to do it sooner than he thought. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of The Note, their political blog, and co-host of Top Line, the webcast on abcnews.com. Busy guy, so thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Well, the three-day sold-out Tea Party convention begins today in Nashville, Tennessee. Another criticism of followers, the high-ticket price, almost $600. Although a spokesperson for the for-profit Tea Party Nation, which is the host group, responded to that criticism by saying, that's an Obama socialist view. For-profit isn't a bad word. Originally, access to the convention was restricted to a handful of media outlets, like Fox News and the Wall Street Journal. But now, Speaker Sarah Palin will be broadcast on cable and the Internet. And an early cheerleader for the movement was Fox TV's Glenn Beck, who went on to form the political organizing group The 912 Project, along with a series of planned conventions to teach political activism, and also in the works a new book from Beck to launch a national movement. Well, who should they back? Beck's already signaled he's not that sure about the Republican Party's new superstar, the aforementioned Scott Brown.
There's already talk now about Brown running for president. May I just say, cool it. Can we actually have people accomplish something first before they become president? I'm just saying.
Well, Glenn Beck would not be the first to use his program as a bully pulpit.
Even though President Roosevelt's commendable peace efforts fail, we are not prepared to assist Germany or Russia or imperialistic France and England in their European wars.
That is a voice from 70 years ago, Father Charles Coughlin, who also used the radio as a political bullhorn, often preaching against then-President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Coughlin's voice has been resonating for journalist Douglas McCollum, especially since the 2008 elections. He joins us now. And Douglas, it's hard to fathom because today it feels as if Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh have pretty big bullhorns. Rush Limbaugh has something like 13.5 million listeners. But you say that's nothing compared to Father Coughlin?
That's right. Coughlin, his audience got as high as 40 million listeners back in the 1930s at a time when America was roughly half the population it is today. So his influence and his reach was considerably larger than any of the pundits on the scene today.
Who was he? Other than, you know, what many of us may know at our fingertips, Canadian-born, a Catholic priest who came to the U.S. and then had this meteoric rise. Who was he?
Well, as you say, he did come from Canada, and he set up shop just outside of Detroit, Michigan, in the early 1930s and the late 1920s. He began to go on radio to try and raise money for his parish. He had built a new church, and he was kind of cash-strapped and in debt to the diocese. And he struck a deal with a local radio station there in Detroit and began to give Sunday sermons, and almost from the very beginning developed a loyal and large following, first starting in the Midwest and then spreading to the East Coast. And I think at his height, he had a network of about 30 stations that carried his broadcast every Sunday. He became so popular that tourists began showing up at his church. He was given an offer for a movie deal. He wrote a book that sold almost 1 million copies in the depths of the Depression, and he became, in time, a very serious political force in American politics.
Well, and early on, he supported then-President FDR.
Very much so. He had a famous phrase in which he said it was Roosevelt or ruin in the 1932 election, and then he began to sour on Roosevelt in 1933 and 1934.
And so put it more in context for us. Roosevelt, we know, started out as Hoover was, as someone who was a belt tightener. And then when the Depression was really making itself evident, he and others felt they had to go to, this is going to be a familiar phrase, you know, deficit spending and all these programs to help save the economy. Is that when Father Coughlin turned?
Well, no, Coughlin was supportive of some of the early elements of the New Deal. I think that it was really more personal for Coughlin. I think he thought he was going to be a member of Roosevelt's inner circle. He used to send him notes advising him on certain issues. He used to contact Roosevelt's advisors and advise them on what to do. And I think as Roosevelt's first year in office wore on, Coughlin became aware that he was not going to become a key advisor for Roosevelt or be admitted into his inner circle. And he became somewhat embittered by that. And he began to find fault with Roosevelt and find fault with the New Deal, and in time grew to be a very bitter and potent foe of Roosevelt.
FDR, we learned from his private papers, early on thought Coughlin was a demagogue. He didn't like him.
He never liked him. And as Roosevelt could do famously, he could charm anyone who he wanted to, and he did charm Coughlin. But he was clear from the beginning that he mistrusted Coughlin, and he mistrusted his clout on the radio and thought him to be something of a demagogue, yes, mm-hmm. right from the beginning.
Well, as he became more and more embittered, what were some of the things Father Coughlin did?
Well, Coughlin began to see a growing radicalness in Roosevelt. He began to see radicals in his administration and speak out about that. He began to warn that the New Deal was sort of a forerunner for Bolshevism in America. And he began to go out and rally his listeners to oppose Roosevelt. And the crowds that would turn out to hear Coughlin were amazing. 20 or 30,000 people in places like Madison Square Garden. And eventually this led to Coughlin announcing his own political organization called the National Union for Social Justice, which he intended to make into a viable political force in American politics for the 1936 elections.
Well, given how many people would turn out to hear him speak, you'd think that that would be a slam dunk, but what happened?
You would, and I think that's sort of instructive even today. Coughlin was very adept at bringing people out for rallies. He had some success in putting up candidates in congressional elections throughout the Midwest and in the eastern states. And for a time, he looked like he was going to be a force to contend with. But the truth was that in the end, his political clout didn't amount to much. He was very good at garnering ratings on the radio and gathering crowds to hear his speeches, but he had very little influence, as it turned out, about how people voted.
Well, but on the other hand, you remind us that in Roosevelt's second term, there was another economic slippage. He attempted a reform package at that time, and Father Coughlin called out his followers to send a telegram to Congress. The response is so overwhelming, you write, that wire services had to shut down, and the bill did flop, and FDR acknowledged that it was Father Coughlin.
He did. He acknowledged that Coughlin had the ability to sort of jam up the telegraphs, as he said, and he was heard to remark at that time that Coughlin showed that demagoguery was one of the great weaknesses of democracy.
But how much clout did Father Coughlin eventually have? That's Douglas McCollum, who writes about the so-called fighting priest, Father Charles Coughlin, in the Columbia Journalism Review. We'll have more just ahead. Later today, are Wikipedia contributors getting most of their information now from Google? And if they are, why do we need Wikipedia? That's later. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. As anti-government Tea Party activists gather in Nashville, cheered on in part by radio talk show hosts like Glenn Beck, we're learning about the fighting priest of the 1930s, Father Charles Coughlin. His radio broadcast became a huge bully pulpit with an estimated 40 million listeners every week. His main target was then-President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Here's Coughlin targeting FDR at a campaign rally in 1936.
And so, Mr. Roosevelt, who was very loquacious in 1933 about driving the money changers out of the temple, is now bent upon another policy. I think driving the workmen out of decent annual wages.
Journalist Douglas McCollum explores the phenomenon of Father Charles Coughlin in the latest Columbia Journalism Review. He joins us now. And Douglas, how much of a factor was that voice? You know, at times it sounds like something out of Tales from the Crypt.
No question about it. The novelist Wallace Stegner said he had a voice made for making promises. And he was one of the first true mass communicators that used radio, that great electronic media of the 1920s and 1930s, to build himself into a true national political figure, to the point where by the early 1930s, he was seen as the most important man in American cultural life next to the president. And you know, by the time of the 1936 presidential election, Coughlin had really become very radical. He talked about bullet holes at the White House and the coming of tyranny to America if Roosevelt was reelected. And ultimately, I think that's more than anything else which began to lead to Coughlin's downfall. He was simply too far out of the mainstream. He was too radical. And he was too angry for many of his listeners to take seriously.
Well, in fact, 18 members of a former of his party were arrested for conspiracy to assassinate members of Congress. This was in 1940. He had already done things like serialize the fake protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a complete hoax, but he presented it as a real conspiracy by Jews to, you know, take over the world.
Yes, as the 1930s wore on and as World War II loomed on the horizon, Coughlin became increasingly enamored of conspiracies and international conspiracies. And people said that there was always sort of a tinge of anti-Semitism to his comments, almost from the beginning of his radio career. But as the 1930s wore on, these anti-Semitic tendencies became more and more pronounced until finally on his radio show, and even more so, he had a national newspaper called Social Justice that began to sort of engage in sort of the worst kinds of anti-Semitic conspiracy fear-mongering. And in fact, he was noted as the Nazis' favorite American commentator by the end of the 1930s.
Well, and the government was noting him as well, and they threatened him with prosecution under the Espionage Act for things he was saying and fomenting. There was a deal struck, and he agreed he'd retire and died in 1979. I was surprised to read that. I didn't realize he'd lived that long into recent times.
He had a long life after he left the radio. His political influence obviously was never again even approached what it had been during his heyday. But it was really the coming of World War II that finally forced him off the air, and the threat of prosecution, as you say, under the Espionage Act and under certain sedition laws. And the Roosevelt administration had a very frank conversation with the Catholic diocese, and Coughlin was basically given an ultimatum that he could either remain a priest or he could get off the air, but he couldn't both stay on the air and remain a Catholic priest. And so he decided to stay in the clergy and abandon his radio and newspaper.
Well, so Douglas McCullum, what do we learn from this? Because you are quick to say, when you take a look at all of that, today's conservative critics seem tame in a lot of ways, their influence, you know, compared to his. Also, you know, I would think some of their invective. But you say you can read some of Coughlin's words and hear them today?
Particularly in some of his themes. You know, of course, Coughlin, as we were just speaking about, was anti-Semitic, and I would never translate that into today. But he would often do things like speak of the uncrowned princes of Wall Street or banksters or the red serpent of socialism that was invading the government.
Well, I just want to stop you there. Just with the first two, you'd hear that from the left today.
That's right. Well. And there was a strong populist message in Coughlin's politics. And you can see that in today's commentators, too. If you listen to people like Glenn Beck, they also will sound that theme about sort of the power of Wall Street and the power of the financial community and, you know, how they hold too much sway. And so in that ways, I think it sort of harkens back to Coughlin.
Well, and you also pick out other words, calling the president a liar, a radical, a communist. Some of the words Coughlin used, some of the words we hear today. But in the end, what do we take from it?
I think in the end that you see this as a part of American democracy. And while it may be alarming to hear some of the things that Glenn Beck says or that Rush Limbaugh says that, you know, seem radical when they, you know, Glenn Beck calls the president a racist or they call him a socialist or sometimes they call him a Stalinist, sometimes they call him a Nazi. They seem to go back and forth. That this is part of a long American tradition, and it was present even back in the 1930s, and President Roosevelt certainly dealt with this and more.
Or didn't. And I think that's another point you make. He didn't get drawn in.
He refused to. That's a very good point, Robin, that he had a very strict policy of not responding. There were advisors who said that he had to hit back, but he very studiously avoided that. He allowed his supporters to do so, and even members of his inner circle. But he himself refused to respond to Coughlin or many of his other detractors under the theory that that just gave them more weight.
And in the end, Coughlin's political aspirations fizzled out. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Glenn Beck's.
It can be easy to mistake ratings for political clout, but they're not the same thing.
Douglas McCollum, a freelance journalist who wrote about Father Charles Coughlin for the Columbia Journalism Review. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Robin. Great to be with you.
Okay, a couple quick notes. Some of the stories we're following. Interesting, President Barack Obama is calling on all lawmakers to bring civility back to the country's capital. Speaking at the annual National Prayer Breakfast, Obama said there's a sense that something is broken in Washington, and Obama is urging leaders to be empowered by faith to step outside their comfort zone to bridge divisions. Also, two U.S.-born giant pandas have left the Washington Zoo of their birth and are headed to China to help with a breeding program there. The pandas were a gift to the American people from China following President Richard Nixon's historic visit. Now the Washington National Zoo is returning the favor. Still ahead today, there are now Wikipedias in 250 languages, but can it keep growing? Back after the latest news, here and now. First, it was sticky gas pedals. Now it's faulty brakes. Yesterday, we reported the Japanese government asked Toyota to look into complaints about anti-lock brakes on its 2010 Prius hybrid. Now the U.S. Transportation Department is investigating. Toyota says the brakes can be fixed with a software update. And as you know, the company is already spending about $2 billion to fix accelerators, gas pedals, on 2 million recalled cars. Well, when we have car problems, we turn to Click and Clack of NPR's Car Talk. So joining us from the Good News Garage in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is half that team, Ray Maliazzi. And Ray, we understand hybrids are part electric, and the braking is different. It's called regenerative braking. Tell us about that.
One of the ways that the hybrid accomplishes such good mileage is that when you're slowing the car down, it uses the energy that would ordinarily be lost to heat to make electricity, and then store that electricity in the battery so that can be used later on to power the car. The systems that are used in that hybrid configuration are pretty complicated and, you know, I suppose prone to errors. And you mix in with that the fact that these cars all have to have anti-lock brakes. It adds another level of complication to the whole process.
Well, Toyota says that they already have a solution.
I've heard about it, but I don't know what their solution is. Evidently, it's some kind of a software upgrade. Maybe, in fact, the brakes are too sensitive or not sensitive enough. I mean, when the anti-lock brake system kicks in is determined by when the computer determines that a wheel is locked up and skidding. And it may be that the computer is responding incorrectly to the inputs it's getting from the wheel sensors, because every anti-lock brake system car is reading the speeds of every single wheel and comparing them all the time. And ideally, you want all the wheels to be slowing down at the same rate. If you listen to Car Talk every week, Robin, you'd know all this stuff.
I know more about, you know, the food you eat, actually. Well, staying with the Toyota problems, CNET News spoke to an auto engineer about the sudden acceleration problem, and he said one of the issues there is that drivers are now one layer removed from controlling the car. In the past, you'd hit the gas, it would open the throttle. Now you hit the gas, and it sends that request to the computer, you know, requesting it to open the throttle.
Well, exactly. Every car has the same setup.
Right.
Back in the old days, there was an actual cable or a linkage that connected the gas pedal in the passenger compartment to the carburetor, so that when you stepped on the gas pedal, this cable got pulled, it opened the throttle, and a larger mixture of gasoline and air got introduced into the engine, and that made the car go faster. Okay, and for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is to make our air cleaner, manufacturers have gone over to this electronic system where when you step on the pedal, what happens is a variable resistor is sending a current to the computer, which is interpreting that information and sending a signal to an electric motor at the throttle, which is opening up the throttle, determined by how much you stepped on the pedal. Your commute from your house to work is, 10 minutes?
At best, right.
During that commute, if you were driving a car of yesteryear, you would be polluting 10 times more than your car is polluting now, because most of the pollution that occurs during what's called the warm-up period, where your car hardly is warmed up by the time you get to work. And if you had an old-fashioned design with a carburetor, the choke would still be partially closed. You'd be polluting the air. And with the modern electronic throttles, they can control everything so precisely that your engine is running very clean within seconds of its being started.
You know, they were telling you if you have that stuck accelerator, you should throw your car into neutral and
Absolutely.
Turn it off. But we've
heard... not turn it off. I think there's been a lot of misinformation
yeah.
out there. We have a thing on our website that tells people what to do, cartalk.com, but do not turn the key off under any circumstances.
Because then you lose power.
You're going to lose your power brakes. You're going to lose your power steering. So the secret is, if the car is running away, move the shifter from drive into neutral. It's one step away. The engine will race like crazy. It'll be scary because the engine will sound like it's going to blow up, but you will not harm the engine. Engines will not blow up if they're over revved now.
Can you, in the car talk way, tell us how it might sound?
It'll be loud.
But it's okay.
It's okay. It really is.
And you say, Ray, at the end of the day, big PR problem, but you think Toyota will recover?
I'm sure they'll recover from it. At the end of the day, they make great cars, and they're going to make even better cars, I think. You know, they'll be more dedicated to being the company that foresees these kinds of problems occurring. And to be fair, virtually every car on the road today, at least every modern car, has an electronic throttle, just like Toyota's.
Ray Maliazzi of NPR's Car Talk. Thank you so much, Ray, for talking to us today.
My pleasure, Robin.
And a quick look ahead to tomorrow. As Super Bowl 44 approaches, we'll bring you the story of the former NFL commissioner, Burt Bell, who founded the NFL draft and coined the league's signature phrase, on any given Sunday. Also, music from Who Dat Nation. That's tomorrow. Back in 30 seconds here and now. Wikipedia is hands down one of the most successful experiments on the Internet. There are now Wikipedias in about 250 languages, while the English version has grown to 25 times the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Our guest, Evgeny Morozov, says, "We've stopped asking if we can trust Wikipedia. We've just bookmarked it." But critics say articles are skewed toward popular culture, and the growth of entries has slowed amid controversies about the site's rules. So, can Wikipedia keep growing? That's the question Morozov asks in his recent essay, Edit This Page, in the Boston Review. He's a contributing editor to Foreign Policy magazine, where he also runs Net Effect, the blog about the Internet's impact on global politics. And he's currently a Yahoo Fellow at Georgetown University and joins us from the NPR studios in D.C. Evgeny, you point out that a lot of what's written on Wikipedia now by these contributors is largely what they gather from Google. So topics about which information is already available on the web end up having the most impressive entries.
Yes, and I think this is one of the main challenges to Wikipedia's growth at this point. There is a limit as to what knowledge is on Google. Wikipedia, from some perspective, is only as good as Google is.
Well, and let's just remind ourselves what the founding philosophy was. The founders, Larry Sanger and Jimmy Wales, had three core rules. They wanted neutrality, verifiability, no original research, because that's what peer groups are for, you know, to vet that. And they also, you point out, were heavily influenced by Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism, meaning that people will act in their own self-interest, but their actions will be rational and therefore will be in everyone's self-interest. So the thinking was that once you've got this community of people fact-checking each other and continually going on and revising, that ultimately what would come out would be neutral and verifiable.
Yes.
And what happened?
Well, I think it was more or less a very successful set of assumptions. What Wikipedia has achieved in its very short history was unthinkable, at the very outset of the project. However, at this point, all of the topics about popular culture have been covered very extensively. If they do want to go beyond this low-hanging fruit, which they do need to somehow adjust their working methods and maybe start working on particular topics or have organized campaigns to improve certain areas of Wikipedia or to improve certain language editions of Wikipedia. And this is where the Wikipedia community at this point is still very much undecided.
Well, you write that actually they've already started to enact many more rules and regulations than they plan to have in the beginning. Actually, the way you tell it, it sort of reminds us, it feels a little bit like the economy. You know, the idea that the invisible hand will guide the marketplace, but oops, maybe we need more regulations. It sounds like the same thing happened at Wikipedia because of disputes over content. And in fact, Wikipedia today is much tighter than it was when it began.
Yes, there have been many of the changes in how Wikipedia works, but not all of them have been triggered by their own internal desire for, you know, being more effective. Some of them have simply been triggered by a lot of scandals, and which Wikipedia often finds itself at the center of. So a lot of celebrities complain about their biographies. So now Wikipedia is rolling out this new improvement to their site, which basically would protect the biographies of all living persons from being edited anonymously.
Well, and let's talk about who who these Wikipedians are. Mm-hmm. You write about WikiCrack, the drug of spending countless hours improving the site without any payment. 80% are male, over 65% are single, over 85% have no children, around 70% are under the age of 30.
So there is this very active core group, and I don't know how much of Wikipedia's content is actually produced by this core group, but let's say it's about a half or 60%, right? And then there is a much bigger layer of pretty much everyone else, you and me, who contribute to Wikipedia occasionally.
Well, and you say that this other layer, this large layer of Wikipedians, is having a harder time getting in because of this inner core of guardians. You write, experts writing on a topic have to engage in debates with them, a system of rules and bureaucracy that can be sort of Kafka-esque. Describe that.
Well, by its very design, Wikipedia does not recognize authority. So you cannot step in and say, I have a PhD, I'm a recognized authority on the subject. Everyone is treated equally, which means that everyone is expected to go through the same line of reasoning, whether you are a Nobel Prize winner or whether you are a high school student. So it is very hard for people with expertise, whose time also tends to be very expensive and limited, to engage in these debates. And of course, a lot of scientists, for example, feel extremely uneasy about Wikipedia. And Wikipedia now has a special outreach program where they actually hold workshops trying to convince scientists that it's worth to contribute to Wikipedia. But again, as long as there are no changes to how the scientists are supposed to debate with other Wikipedians, I think it'll be a very tough sell.
Well, and this is one of the criticisms of Jaron Lanier, his new book, You Are Not a Gadget. He says that, you know, this idea that the voice of an expert is dispensable is a problem. You know, he says that the wisdom of crowds is a tool that should be used selectively, not glorified for its own sake, which is sort of the bottom line of Wikipedia.
Well, I think there are trade-offs. I think if we did start a project where expertise was valued, we would not have achieved the Wikipedia that we have now. In fact, one of Wikipedia's co-founders, Larry Zanger, he actually tried to create a project which relied on Wiki's ethos, but then also used a different method of ranking expertise. It failed. So while I agree with many of the criticisms that Lanier makes in his book, we should also realize that we wouldn't really have what we have now if we try to build it differently. The big question for me is, how can you restructure Wikipedia now without alienating all the existing contributors, but still bringing in more new ones? And I think this is the big issue facing Wikipedia.
That's Evgeny Morozov, contributing editor of Foreign Policy magazine, who also runs the Net Effect blog about the Internet. And he is currently a Yahoo Fellow at Georgetown University. His article on Wikipedia is entitled Edit This Page. It's in the Boston Review. Evgeny, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, take care. A little housekeeping here. Just a reminder, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also download a podcast, take us with you. You can send an email. Just click on Contact Us. You can also leave a comment. Just scroll down and there is a place to do that as well. That's hereandnow.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. Before we go today, a history of love letters. You're listening, as you've probably gathered, to Here and Now. Valentine's Day is a week from Sunday, not too early to start crafting a love letter. For centuries, couples have used the written word to express their feelings. According to a new book, the Western world's first famous epistolary lovers were the 12th century nun Eloise and her former teacher turned monk, Peter Abelard. For Eloise, the letters became her lover.
They have souls. They can speak. They have in them all that force which expresses the transports of the heart. They have all the fire of our passions. They can raise them as much as if the persons themselves were present.
But couples' correspondence isn't always pretty. There was Harold Ross, editor of The New Yorker. Here's his missive to his missus.
We have different tastes, different interests, different instincts, different ideas. We are distinctly two entities, two personalities. We differ in almost everything. Living with you on the basis that I have in the past is, I have concluded, impossible.
Ouch. Thomas Mallon has put together a history of letter writing in a new book, Yours Ever, People and Their Letters. He joins us on the line from the Argo Network studios in New York with more. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, for our purposes today, we're concentrating on your chapter named Love. And you say love letters, they are living things.
The physicality of letters, I think, is very important. And they used to play a real role in courtships and romances. People would ask for them back if they broke up. They would tear them up, and that would give a certain kind of satisfaction. Or if everything went well, they would save them, and they would look at them, you know, years and years later. All of that has more or less gone away with email.
Well, we want to talk more about modern-day letter writing, but let's go way back to what you call the Western world's first famous pair of epistolary lovers. This is Eloise and her teacher, Peter Abelard, and it had a disastrous ending. Just remind us a little bit about their story.
Under the watchful eyes of her uncle, Fulbert, he unfortunately fell in love with her. Eloise and he had a child. They married in secret. They ran away. But in the end, this only exasperated or enraged Uncle Fulbert, who famously had Peter Abelard castrated, which fitted him for the monastic life. He also convinced Eloise to enter a nunnery. And so some of the correspondence they had about their love is really very retrospective.
Well, as she writes to him, in spite of all our misfortunes, you may be what you please in your letter. Another pair of lovers whose letters you analyze are Russian playwright Anton Chekhov and actress Olga Knipper. These letters were a way they could overcome their separation. She was an actress and on tour. Chekhov was by then ailing in Yalta?
Yes.
And you say she was the one in her letters who would want to, and now we switch to capital letters, talk about the relationship.
Chekhov and Olga, they're both very charming and they're both extremely neurotic. The correspondence is always kind of fraught, especially with Olga's need for reassurance. I describe her in the book as a virtuoso of the passive-aggressive. She says at one point, "You're sick of writing to me. You don't feel anything when you write to me. Isn't that right?" And so he has to deal with all this from afar, and he is kind of gentle and reassuring. "You're a goose, sweetheart. Never while I'm your husband will I take you away from the theater." Whatever her anxiety of the moment is, she sees it placated by him.
Yeah. Be careful of the love letters that have trapdoors in them, like that one. I want to talk about President Woodrow Wilson and his first girlfriend, but then wife, Edith Galt. He was a widower when they first met. He was absolutely besotted by her, to an extent that's kind of disturbing to read, given that there was a war going on.
Well, at one point, he begins to send her state papers across town. And, you know, we think of Wilson as this very skinny, I call him a skinny pillar of rectitude, with those glasses, the former professor. I mean, in some ways, the most intellectual of all of our presidents, I suppose, if you don't count Thomas Jefferson in that. And yet, to say the least, he was very, very highly sexed. And when he is getting to know Edith, he's in his late 50s, and he is so, as you say, besotted with her that he really begins to neglect his job for a while. And his White House aides and those around him are beginning to worry about this distraction, particularly in this period when the First World War has broken out in Europe and Wilson is struggling to keep the United States out of it.
What was really on his mind throughout these war summers, as you write, he writes to her, "If ever again I have to be with you for an hour and a half with only two stolen glances to express my all but irresistible desire to take you in my arms and smother you with kisses, I am sure I shall crack an artery."
Yes, I mean, if you were giving a history test to the average student of American history and, you know, you asked, identify the president who wrote this letter, I don't think Wilson would be the answer. I think you'd probably get a lot of wrong answers from maybe Bill Clinton. This is not really our picture of Wilson, but it was very much part of him, and it was all-consuming for him in 1915. And after a six-month courtship, they got married, and then the letters stopped. And that's one of the odd things about love letters is once the affair reaches a successful conclusion, once the lovers get over all of the obstacles that they've been talking about in the letters and they get together, they get married, they live together, the letters stop and we don't get the rest of the story.
Well, I just want to touch on a couple of the love letter exchanges that you tell us about that really weren't all that lovely. Because one is shocking. We think of the love story of the Duke and Duchess of Windsor as being one of the most profound of, you know, the 20th century. The Duke, who would have been Edward VIII, decides to abdicate the throne rather than renounce the woman he loved, Wallis Simpson. It's a great story, but their letters, not so much.
Well, his side of the correspondence is just icky. It's full of baby talk and endearments, and he's kind of infantile and dependent. And, you know, the Brits were so horrified at the idea of the twice-divorced Mrs. Simpson, as she was always referred to in the press, might become their queen. But anybody who reads the letters from this remove, I think, really feels that she did England a favor by taking him off the throne. He was just a kind of royal twit, at least in the correspondence. And there are no grand Shakespearean pleasures to be had from reading it.
Yeah. And then there was William Wordsworth, who really wanted his wife to write him love letters when they were apart. And she tries so hard. But yeah, she's back home raising the kids and cooking. And, you know, it's, you sort of get this feeling of, oh, God, you know, one more thing I have to do.
Is the correspondence between the Wordsworth, it's lovely, it's warm, but it's the correspondence of married love. And I think I say somewhere in the book that it's the flannel nightgown instead of the black negligee.
But you know what? There's something to be said for flannel nightgowns. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where do you think we're headed with love letters? Are they already endangered? You know, we are in the I heart you generation. Are letters endangered?
Oh, sure. Yeah. They're really becoming a special occasion genre. I suspect, though, that the love letter will survive longer than other kinds of letters because there is a sense that if you're going to express passion to somebody, and private passion in particular, that an email is somehow a little unseemly, or a text or a tweet.
And I'm thinking when it comes to love letters, you can have your emailed love letters in a file, but it's just not the same as sort of wrapping them with a ribbon and tucking them in a drawer.
Yeah, the clutch of letters, the bundle of letters, you know, the drama of the handwriting. If you have letters from somebody you loved, even, say, love between a parent and a child, if you hang on to those letters, you see the parent age, you see the handwriting shrink, you see it get quavery. And there's a poignancy there that I don't really think you are going to have in the same way with electronic communication.
Yeah. That's Thomas Mallon. His book is Yours Ever, People and Their Letters. Thomas Mallon, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.